From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. A lot has changed since this ad was approved.
You know, if you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out for many men of medicine usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, they're particular about the brand they choose.
So many things wrong in that ad, aside from the fact that not all doctors are men anymore. Smoking is bad for you. Very bad. No reputable health professional would recommend it. But is there a safer way to smoke? There's new research on electronic cigarettes that we'll dig into this hour. First, though, let's talk about TV. Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Jennifer Brett was my guest yesterday, and we caught up on one local network's decision to return The Cosby Show to the air. Many stations pulled that sitcom off after sexual assault allegations rose against Bill Cosby.
It's coming back in December, and they said that they have heard from their viewers who very much make the distinction between Bill Cosby, the man who is facing all of these allegations, and Dr. Cliff Huxtable, the fictitious character.
So I asked if our listeners were able to make that distinction easily as well. Here are your first thoughts. Thunder Shrike tweets, "It's not about Cosby versus Huxtable. It's about supporting an abuser and his work versus solidarity to the victims and survivors." John Hayes agrees. He tweets, "We all know the difference between Cliff Huxtable and Bill Cosby, but when Bounce TV pays for Cosby Show episodes, a serial rapist gets paid." Bounce is the name of the local network that will air the show again beginning in December. Very hard to talk about the entertainment industry in Georgia without mentioning The Walking Dead. That show has taken a big hit in the ratings recently, and we asked if you still watch it. Janny Girl G and Tony Stark's tweet, "They still enjoy the show. Tony adds, wished they would continue a story instead of starting a new one." But Amber Ravenscroft tweets, I think it's supposed to say bored. She said boated, but I'm assuming that's bored. "I got bored near the end of season 3. Maybe I'll come back to it. Probably not, though." You know, we always love to get your thoughts and comments. You can reach us on Twitter at OST Talk. We're also on Facebook. Or call us and leave a message. It's 404-500-9457. And remember, we might use your comments on the show. Yesterday, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal suspended all 5 members of the Dooley County School Board following concerns about the district's accreditation. High school graduation rates in Georgia remain below the national average, but data released just last month by the U.S. Department of Education shows the state has improved in that area. Governor Nathan Deal's plan to allow a state takeover of failing schools failed at the ballot office, but Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle has his own ideas on how we might improve the education system. They're outlined in his new book, Education Unleashed, and he joins me in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, so it's good to be with you today.
It's nice to have you, and let's just get this out of the way.
What is that? It's raining outside? Is that what you want to
well,
get
Well, that's
out of
lovely, but is You're this right. book a lead up to a run for the governor's office?
I don't think you have to write a book to run for governor, but you
it
know,
helps though.
Well, the reality is, you know, for us and really for me, it took me 3 years to write the book, and it's been a real passion of mine. Really, when I first was elected to lieutenant governor in 2006, and prior to that as a state senator, really focusing on improving public education, and you outlined a couple of statistics in your intro, and I think it is really important to also note that 1 of 4 of our students live in poverty, and I believe very fundamentally that education is the great equalizer. And in the book, we talk about really how you're able to create an educational system that really does drive the economy, and education does drive the economy, and it's important that we view it in that context. And so we have to bring real relevance into the classroom for kids, and we're able to do that with our college and career academies, which give specific skill sets and career paths that students can learn and get on the front end and be more proactive in their educational components. We've been able today to have about 40 of those college and career academies across the state, where we see a graduation rate of 98% and 100% placement rate when they're done. Those are the kind of successes we want to see more of.
So one of the things that you really talk about a lot in the book is giving the first thing is rethinking how we measure student achievement.
Correct.
Because we have been under No Child Left Behind in the past that uses a lot of standardized tests. Mm-hmm. You say specifically that the top-down approach does not work.
Correct.
What does that mean?
So obviously, it's a governance structure that is very, very important. And when you have a top-down style of management, unfortunately—
Meaning federal standards coming down to individual schools?
So basically, you have two components. One is that the federal government is sending down more rules and regulations. The state is doing the same thing at the local level. And so at the end of the day, teachers really feel as if their hands are tied. They're not able to do what I call individualized learning plans for specific needs of the student. And it's about designing an educational system that, one, meets the need of the community, but more importantly, meets the need of the individual student, okay? And it's what I talk about is moving from a compliance model of checking all the boxes and doing all the things that rules and regs are telling
teaching
you to do.
Teaching to the test.
Yeah, and teaching to the test, and more of, you know, more initiatives that have come down from Washington, like No Child Left Behind, along with Common Core and other things, to moving to an achievement-based model, which really is about the need of the individual student and finding where they may be deficient and how you improve in the earlier levels.
How do you do that then, both teach to individual students and make sure that kids are all getting a common level of curriculum, that they're all getting their, well, we're not doing civics anymore, but they're all learning certain novels, that they're all learning the certain level of math?
Correct. Well, what I say is the vision that I plan is a vision that has an academic floor that every student has to achieve. But within that floor, there are no cracks for students to drop between, and there's no ceiling to hold a student back. Now, when I say that, what we're talking about is that, you know, for so long, we've kind of had a one-size-fits-all educational system that really says that every single student needs to be on the same path.
And going to college.
Ultimately, that's a liberal arts degree, right? And so, sadly enough, it has left a lot of children behind. And so having an academic floor and getting a student as high as far as they can be academically, and then preparing them for what life is going for life after education is very critical as well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. He's author of the new book, Education Unleashed. I kind of feel like you need an exclamation point on the end of that. But what do you then support trade schools? Because you do talk quite a bit about individualized education and, as you say, preparing them for the life that they will lead as opposed to the life that the state wants to prepare them for.
Right.
So would you support then trade schools instead of a college prep?
So basically, this is what a couple of things that I would point out to that. We did a survey last year that demonstrated that there were 20,000 jobs that were available in the healthcare industry. 20,000 jobs. We graduated that required a 2-year degree. We graduated about 5,000 students to fill those jobs, leaving 15,000 job deficit. On the same token, we graduated in the liberal arts sector or degree, a 2-year degree. We actually graduated 5,000 of those students. And guess how many jobs were available? They were 500 jobs. So the point I'm making is education has to be aligned with what the industry needs are in order for the student to be successful, but also for business to be successful too. If we build a world-class workforce that is second to none, we will see companies continue to come here, but also companies that will grow and thrive and be successful. And so part of that is to your earlier point, is that yes, there is a skill set, a skill gap that exists within our country where we're not preparing enough students to really meet the needs of what industry has. And through the technical side of that, we need far more in the allied health arena in the health industries. We also in manufacturing need a lot more industrial mechanics that are out there. And so it is through our college and career academy, which is a standalone facility at the high school where you literally have high school and technical college or post-secondary married, mirroring one another and teaching kids on a technical path of learning that leads them to a job.
Now, you've been very supportive of charter schools, and the charter schools have now been around for a quarter of a century, almost 25 years now.
Mm-hmm.
But every study we've had has shown that students at charter schools have done pretty much just about the same as kids at public schools, or in many cases, worse.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you make charter schools work without weakening the public school system?
Well, obviously what my proposal is called a charter system, and it allows the entire school to convert to a contractual or an accountability contract, which is a very important piece. And it also requires real local governance and local governance teams where you really, again, get away from the top down and you put the power and the ownership at the lowest level there in the individual schools and you manage up accordingly. Now, you know, charter schools themselves are standalone individual entities. A charter system is the entire school that then has a new governance structure with the governance council teams there in place that allows the teachers, the parents, the principals, and others, the stakeholders, to really say, how do we move the needle? How do we get every student reading on grade level? How do we accomplish efficiency as it pertains to math and other academic standards? And then we move that needle up, and they set goals, and obviously they reach them. The beautiful thing about today, we have 20% of all of our students that are under a charter system. And the success that has come out of that, every single one of them on average are outperforming every other school as it relates to the milestone test, which is the test that the state implements. So we're seeing tremendous success. And this is the reason. A one-size-fits-all, for me to come in and say that this is the best way to educate students in Atlanta versus students that may be in Athens is very, very different. And the way you allocate resources and the way you assign teachers and other things are very different. And so we allow a complete clear slate to allow them to design.
But here's the danger in that.
Okay.
If you have local control and suddenly that small local government decides they don't want to teach evolution or they don't want to teach dinosaurs or there's certain novels mm-hmm. that they find offensive and so they decide not to teach mm-hmm. maybe a pillar of American literature, mm-hmm. who then steps in to say, hold on, there needs to be academic standards?
Well, obviously there's freedom and flexibility, but there's also accountability as well. Okay, so in a contractual agreement that you enter into with the state, obviously there are some things that you can't, you know, just have complete freedom from. But the idea is, when it comes to a system where we have been under that says you have to have 16 students to one teacher, that's the ratio in which you have. Well, does that really work, right? I mean, the freedom and flexibility says, well, wait a second. I may need, for this particular student group, I may need 8 students to one teacher. I may need 8 students to one teacher and a parapro. That's flexibility, and that's a system that is designed around the need of the student and getting them
flexibility in how you teach, not always what.
Not always what. That's right. That's right. And we're talking about, obviously, the implementation and how, you know, how to get better outcomes. When you have graduation rates that we have, this is not acceptable. When you have the number of schools that are on the failing list, this is not acceptable. And we have to improve. And really, it's not just simply for the student, but it's for society as a whole.
That is Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. His book is called Education Unleashed. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. A joy.
2016 is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize, and our celebration of winners from Georgia comes together in a series we call Pulitzer Peaches. This month, we honor the late journalist Eugene Patterson. He won the Pulitzer for editorial writing in 1967. Patterson was executive editor and vice president of the Atlanta Journal of the Atlanta Constitution, and he played a monumental role in the civil rights movement throughout the 1960s through his work with that paper.
We were slowly at first, and then decisively committing that newspaper to supporting the U.S. Supreme Court and telling our kinsmen in the American South, look, you have got to obey the law. And worse, what we've been doing is wrong. That's tough, because you're telling a Southern white that what his daddy and his granddaddy believed was wrong, and that's hard to accept.
Eugene Patterson's story started in Georgia. It did not end there, though. Civil rights leader and broadcaster Zernona Clayton joins me now to talk about his legacy. She will induct Eugene Patterson into the Atlanta Press Club Hall of Fame later tonight. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and I'm so thrilled to talk about my good friend.
So the job of journalist during the period of the civil rights movement was not easy. What made that position so tricky?
Well, it was tricky because you were in an environment where you knew there was a clear division of one on the right, one on the left, black versus white. But what was so important about that is you had people who were willing to go out on the limb and make the statement, as Mr. Patterson did, like, I guess he was a forerunner of, can't we all get along? He really wanted us to live together as a society, both blacks and whites together. And it took courage. And so this man was really one of those courageous leaders who wrote and expressed exactly how he felt. And everybody knew it. He was consistent all the time on his issues of black and white relationships.
So he wrote an editorial in 1963 that became very famous. It was called A Flower for the Graves. He ended up reading it on live TV on Walter Cronkite's News Hour. It was in response to the church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, that killed four young black girls. That was Eugene Patterson overcome by emotion. What made that so effective when it got read and then broadcast nationally?
I think it's because they were children. You know what we understand all the time, and I still live by this. I go to the airport, and I see little kids who always say, oh, look at baby, baby. And little children will gravitate toward each other. They will share the little toys. And what that is saying to me is that they now know no difference between that baby and me, so to speak. It proves to us that discrimination, hatred, separation of the races, all of that is taught. It's taught by older people who put this evil thought into these children's mind. If you just let people grow up and live together in a society, it will work. Eugene Patterson knew that here were little children who would start off with a balanced life, balanced meaning they know no difference. Here they were in church learning about religious responsibility and the teachings of being good citizens, perhaps, knowing nothing more than maybe the goodness that's being taught by them. And he said, this just shouldn't happen. Later on, when people get their own ideas and hatred enters their minds and their thoughts, it becomes in a different matter. But children are innocent. And it was very, very painful for him. But so was it painful for all good-thinking people around this world. It was a big moment in race relations and the hatred and bigotry and to see what it can do.
So we have about a 2 minutes left, but I didn't want to leave the conversation without also talking about his ethics, which is something many, even the Pulitzer Committee, commented on. At one part, he was charged with driving while intoxicated. He insisted his staff put that story on the front page so he could tell anyone, I quote, I put myself on page one, so you can't ask me not to put you there. What separated Eugene Patterson, do you think, from his colleagues?
Courage, honesty, decency, and consistency. If you'll tell on yourself, then you're free to talk about others. That was a brave moment. How many people want to write about themselves in a negative way? But if you got courage, you can do it. And he demonstrated it. He proved again that you have to have courage to be an important and impressive and respected leader, and that's what he was viewed as, a leader with conscience and conviction and honesty and decency. And so when he acted in an indecent way, according to our societal governance, then he was willing to face it and write about it.
My guest is Zernona Clayton. She's president of the Trumpet Awards Foundation and a friend of journalist Eugene Patterson. Patterson will be posthumously inducted into the Atlanta Press Club Hall of Fame tonight. Zernona, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You can get more of our Pulitzer Peaches series at gpbnews.org. Let's hear Eugene Patterson in his own words. This is an excerpt from a lecture he gave at the Washington Journalism Center in 1987.
To go on talking about substance in the news for a minute, I'll do what everybody in the news business has to do sooner or later, and that is quote Scotty Reston. Today's television, he said, with its fleeting lights and shadows, focuses on the personality and encourages everything that's bright and superficial. what looks best rather than what is best? Who can get elected rather than who can govern the country? I think the need to restore a healthier measure of substance over form in public life challenges newspapers directly. It's our job to point out the political dodgers who try to obscure the real agenda, to explain the issues they find inconvenient, to note the vacancies behind the empty smiles, to label the hogwash. Public preoccupation with the bright and the superficial can get scary. Political editor John Harwood of the St. Petersburg Times gathered some focus groups in various areas of America recently and let them talk about qualities they'll look for in the next president of this country. The most common traits they valued were strength, decisiveness, and leadership. But strong for what? Deciding which? Leading where? Harwood found the voters he talked to were less interested in the policies their president would pursue, or the ideologies he would hold to, or the stands he could be expected to take on issues, than they were in the strength, decisiveness, and leadership he would display. What looks best, as Reston said, rather than what is best. Charm glittering in the television lights, demagoguery sliding past in bursts of amplified words that are not written down to be reflected upon.
Triumph of Peace sits prominently in Atlanta's Piedmont Park. The statue features a woman at rest on her side, hand thoughtfully on her chin. The model who inspired this sculpture and countless other works of art around the world is Audrey Munson. Her identity was unknown and her work went uncredited for years, but author James Bone recently documented the life of the mysterious model in his book, The Curse of Beauty, the scandalous and tragic life of Audrey Munson, America's first model.
The story of Audrey Munson is in plain view. You can see her story all around you, and you don't know you can see it. And once you do see it, you can't forget it.
Bone stopped by a studio in the United Kingdom to share a little of Munson's captivating story.
Pretty much until her 40th birthday, Audrey Munson lived with her mother. And her mother was a stage mother. Audrey Munson went to live in Providence, Rhode Island. She went to Catholic school, and it was one of those schools where the nuns would teach you to sing and dance. And so she learned to sing and she learned to dance. She learned to play instruments. And her mother pushed her onto the stage. And as a young girl in her mid-teens, the mother and daughter moved to New York City where she was a chorus girl. And it was while Audrey Munson, age 17, was a chorus girl on Broadway. Actually, she appeared in one of her early productions in the first production that Al Jolson appeared in.
And when my work is done, coming home, for the setting sun, from the gate he'll start to run, and then I'll kiss my boy.
And it was while she was a chorus girl, obviously a very beautiful young woman, that she was window shopping with her mother on Fifth Avenue, and they noticed a strange man following them. And the mother was a bit miffed at this, and pulled her daughter into a store to try and shake the man, and the man just waited outside. So finally, the mother, Kitty, went outside and confronted this man, said, "Well, why are you following my daughter?" And the man very politely doffed his hat and said, "Well, excuse me, madam, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I'm a photographer." Now, if somebody did that to you these days in New York, first of all, about half the population of New York, as far as I can figure out, are photographers, you would probably run a mile. But in those times, and that was in 1909, photographers were a rarity, and this man was actually quite a prominent photographer of that era. And so Audrey Munson started posing for all of the leading artists of the day, and she posed not just for sculptors, she posed for tapestries, for book illustrations, for stained glass, for magazines. Because she was an artist model, she could get away with posing nude. And so in 1915, in a film called Inspiration, she became America's first naked movie star, the first American movie star to appear fully naked on screen. And that was a real landmark. And of course, she became very popular. The trade press advised the theatre owners that on the final day of the run, they should call out the police, because they said otherwise the gentlemen who aren't admitted to the sold-out show will riot. So that gives you an idea of how popular she was. She then got involved with the rich set in New York and Newport, Rhode Island. She had slowly worked her way up from very humble boyfriends through richer and richer and richer boyfriends until she finally got involved with the richest bachelor in America at the time, who was somebody called Herman Ulrich Jr. Enormously wealthy young man, and she had a very unhappy relationship with him, because I discovered Herman Ulrich Jr.'s love letters to a ballet dancer in Paris. And it was a male ballet dancer. And Herman Ulrich Jr., it turns out, like his friend Cole Porter, who wrote the song Anything Goes, was a closet homosexual. And in fact, they both had an affair with this same male ballet dancer in the same year, 1925. And so when you hear that song, Anything Goes, there's quite a backstory to that song.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was a look on to something shocking. But now, God knows, anything goes. Could offer to...
So, Audrey Munson then had an extremely unlucky turn of events when, on her 40th birthday, her mother had her committed to a lunatic asylum. She had become increasingly paranoid. She had become increasingly agitated. And so the most perverse present from a mother to a daughter on her 40th birthday was to commit her to a lunatic asylum.
Who's in their hearts? But when I think of you, another shower starts.
Audrey Munson spent an incredible 65 years in that lunatic asylum. She was there until her death in 1996 at the age of 104 years old.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
We can still see Audrey Munson in our daily lives, the way she transforms the way you look around you and opens your eyes to all of these things that we just ignore in our daily lives. So next time you're in Piedmont Park and you're looking at the Peace Monument, you think of this story about Audrey Munson and you won't see it in the same way.
James Bone is the author of The Curse of Beauty, The Scandalous and Tragic Life of Audrey Munson, America's First Model.
To each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Electronic cigarettes, e-cigs, have been around for more than a decade. They allow users to inhale vaporized liquid nicotine instead of smoke, and they were meant to be a healthier alternative to regular cigarettes. But a new study from Georgia State University suggests the public does not consider e-cigs to be any healthier than cigarettes. In fact, public skepticism of e-cigs tripled between 2012 and 2015. Dr. Michael Erickson is dean of Georgia State's School of Public Health, and he was also a lead researcher in the study, and he joins us now. Hi there.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. What is the extent of what we know about public perception? In other words, we know that the public is very skeptical of e-cigarettes because of your research, but do we know why?
We didn't ask why per se, but we have an idea that they're getting really conflicted messages from the media and from scientists on either side of the e-cigarette issue, and it's no wonder they're either confused or they think that they're as harmful as cigarettes, and that's just not the right perception. In fact, it's a misperception. But it is a complicated issue because for smokers, there's no question that e-cigarettes are less harmful than smoking, but there are other issues associated with the product. It's not safe, but it's less harmful, and communicating that is a difficult public education mission.
So also with us is Dr. Kristen Higgins, assistant professor at the Department of Radiation Oncology at Emory University's Winship Cancer Institute. Hi, Kristen.
Hello.
So this is a common complaint about medicine, right? That the message is confusing, that people don't know what the bottom line is. Do we have a bottom line on e-cigarettes?
Well, yes, I think we can say that we do. E-cigarettes have been in the U.S. markets since around 2007. They haven't been rigorously evaluated in terms of longitudinal clinical trials where we can really assess what the long-term effects of these e-cigarettes could be.
You said longitudinal studies, but does that mean how many years are we talking in order to qualify as longitudinal?
Well, I mean, I think that we need many years because a cigarette or an e-cigarette causing a cancer could take many, many years.
They've been available.
Exactly. More than 1 or 2 years. We can test the acute side effects of e-cigarettes in users, but in terms of the risk of developing cancer down the road, COPD, long-term pulmonary side effects, we're not going to know that for many years until these rigorous scientific studies have been performed.
Okay, so let me bring that back to you, meaning that right now it feels like what I understand is that e-cigarettes aren't healthy, but they're healthier than a cigarette. But it sounds like Kristen is saying we don't actually know that for sure when it comes to causing cancer.
I think that most people would agree that what you said, that e-cigarettes are not safe, but they're better than smoking, people would agree with, because for the sole reason that cigarettes are so toxic and so deadly, 1 out of 2 lifetime smokers will die as a result of smoking. And so all of that's associated with combustion, of burning tobacco leaves and inhaling carbon monoxide and carcinogens into your lungs. E-cigarettes don't have any combustion products, so it's better than smoking, but it's not safe. So what we'd like to try to do is to move smokers from combustion to other forms of nicotine if they need it. Ideally, quit all nicotine, but if they need e-cigarettes to quit smoking, most people would agree that's not controversial. The controversy is around the unintended consequences of doing that, like with kids or people using both, continuing to smoke and using e-cigarettes at the same time, which is, in fact, what's happening in this country.
So it sounds like the reason that you had cause for concern, and again, we're talking about this study from Georgia State University that shows the public thinks e-cigarettes are as deadly as cigarettes.
Right.
It sounds like you're concerned about that because you don't want to dissuade smokers from giving up an actual burning, smoking cigarette.
That's right. If we can get smokers to give up a burning cigarette, a combusted cigarette, and try a electronic cigarette, that would clearly be a step in the right direction of improving their health. And I think everybody would agree with that. But that's not saying that these e-cigarettes are safe. It's just that they're safer than continued smoking.
So, Kristen, what are your concerns about the way that e-cigarettes have been marketed?
My concern is that our youth is going to think that these are a safe alternative to, the classic cigarette, and they're going to start using them, to get a nicotine fix, and eventually that will lead to tobacco use.
Oh, you think that it might be a gateway drug is probably a little bit overused, but that it might lead to actual tobacco use.
I think that is a worry, yes.
But are you concerned about the carcinogens or the possible development of cancer from e-cigarettes? Because e-cigarettes aren't burning anything. There's no smoke.
Yes. Well, I think that the important thing is that we can't make assumptions. We really need to perform, studies and look at rates of cancer development down the road in e-cigarette users. It's really, I think that they probably, yes, are safer than a typical combustible cigarette, but we don't want to assume anything, and we don't want to give that message to the public that we can assume that their cancer risk is going to be negligible if they use this. It needs to be studied in a rigorous fashion.
Yeah, the problem is that there are 40 million Americans who continue to smoke today.
Which
astounds me that there are that many people who do. I mean, smoking rates are at an all-time low, but still 40 million people continue to smoke. And for those 40 million, we really can't wait decades to get the answer on e-cigarettes. We need to get them to stop smoking with whatever means possible. I used to smoke. I quit cold turkey, and most people quit cold turkey. But that's not the only way to do it. There's approved drugs.
And it's also really hard to do that without starting to use them again. Quit cold turkey, I mean.
Well, most smokers, there, in terms of smoking, there are more ex-smokers in the United States today than current smokers. So 53 million Americans have quit smoking, 40 million continue to smoke. So quitting smoking is doable, and most people who've ever smoked have quit. But still there are 40 million who continue. Most people who quit cold turkey. They just quit on their own. Some use pharmaceuticals, some use other means. And I think what we want to do is to get people to quit with however possible. And if that includes e-cigarettes, that's okay.
We're talking about threading a needle here, and this seems to be the problem, Kristen, because you're talking about you don't want people to just take up e-cigarettes, either to just use them because they think they're safe or to use them and that eventually leads to tobacco use. He's talking about
exactly
trying to get people
quit. It's two different populations, two distinct populations. You know, I see patients with lung cancer in my clinic every day, and I counsel them on the importance of tobacco cessation. And we talk about what they've tried, what sort of nicotine replacement tools have they used. And we do talk about e-cigarettes, and they work for some people as a tool to stop smoking. And the message becomes...
Do you encounter this perception that people have that they're just as bad as cigarettes?
Yes, I think that there is some confusion amongst the general public. Yes, I do encounter that perception.
So how do we thread this needle between making smokers know that e-cigarettes are safer and letting everybody else who's maybe not using or thinking about using know that they're not safe?
Well, I think one important thing is that within the medical community, primary care physicians and, you know, all of the medical community really needs to stay abreast of the current literature that's coming out about e-cigarettes, because there is a lot of new literature that's being published every day, and we really need to stay on top of it so we can convey the appropriate message to our patients. I think it needs to be an individual message. It needs to be individualized to the patient that's sitting in front of you in your office. What is their problem? You know, do they have a lung cancer? Do they need to stop smoking today? You know, and the message is going to be different depending on the individual patient scenario.
I think the needle isn't that difficult to thread. I think that the message for smokers is first quit immediately, because there's nothing better you could do for your health than quitting. Secondly, if you tried other methods and they haven't worked, try e-cigarettes and see if they can help you. They can give you the nicotine that you're addicted to, and you could ideally stop e-cigarettes as well. But stopping combustion is number one. The other part of the message is that there's no role for nicotine, either cigarettes or e-cigarettes, for kids. And that is not acceptable. We know it damages the brain. Nicotine increases craving for other drugs in the adolescent brain. And the third part of the message is that, unfortunately, most people who try e-cigarettes continue to smoke at the same time.
Right, so regular cigarettes.
Right. So we have what's called dual use. So they're smoking when they can and using e-cigarettes when they can't, and that's not the answer either. So it has to be moving from smoking to possibly using e-cigarettes, exclusive use of e-cigarettes, but get rid of the smoking and keep it away from kids.
But Kristen, to a certain extent, when I went and looked up e-cigarettes and I went through Google Images, mm-hmm. I kind of see what you're saying, because they bejewel them. They make them the e-cigarettes are really pretty and shiny, and they put rhinestones on them.
The flavors appeal to, I think, the younger generation certainly too.
Right, and they make them with all these flavors. There's even mm-hmm. a pumpkin spice flavored e-cigarette that I saw when I was looking through. So, there is this problem. I'm talking to two doctors, but you guys are not marketing for e-cigarettes and using this message of safer but not safe. That doesn't sell well.
Well, exactly. And I think the message that is being marketed to youth is not the message that we want. That's the problem. That's where, you know, that's where there's a problem. And that's, you know, right now is really a critical time because we need to make sure that we're really keeping our youth safe from this conflicting message.
Does that need to be regulated in the way that we regulate smoking ads for cigarettes, which are fairly highly regulated?
On the regulation side around marketing, in your lifetime, you've never seen a cigarette ad on television. They were banned in 1971. I'm assuming how old you
That's,
are.
Yeah.
Okay. So
pretty
okay,
much.
We'll
yep.
Stop there.
yeah.
But now e-cigarettes. Today, you can turn on many stations and see advertisements for e-cigarettes on television, elsewhere. There's no restrictions currently in the United States for advertising e-cigarettes. So that's an area that needs to be regulated and not necessarily banned, but it needs to be done in a factual, informative way so that smokers can make the proper decisions to whether to use the product or not.
So we have a few minutes left, and I hate to heap this on your head, but it feels to me like this discussion gets to a larger discussion, which is there's a job you can get now, and you can get training to become a science translator. I'm sure you both know about this, to translate the research that comes from research labs and doctors so that the public can understand it. How do we solve, because some of this is just translation, right? Some of it is just message. How do we get the knowledge of doctors to the public in a way where it's not confusing or conflicting?
Well, let me start with that. And at Georgia State, we have one of the 14 grants that FDA has funded to provide the research to inform the public about tobacco and tobacco regulation and electronic products. And the study that we did, we do annual surveys understanding how the public feels about e-cigarettes and what they think and what they know and who they trust. That type of information needs to be used to communicate to smokers clearly what we know and what we don't know, and that help them make an informed decision. Same with kids. We need to clearly communicate to kids that these products are not safe for them. If they've never smoked, they should stay away from these. The problem, as you said, though, is they're marketed in such a way
right.
that they're glamorous, attractive, they look like Apple products, they have flavors,
they do.
And people can use other drugs in them. So it gets to be very complicated. But communication, public education and communication hasn't been done well and is key to really moving us forward in this issue.
In the minute that we have left, Kristen, how can we improve the way we get that information out that might counteract the marketing?
Well, I think even within the medical community, doctors can educate their patients. I encourage patients to, when they're seeing their physician on their yearly checkup, ask about e-cigarettes, ask what their doctor's perceptions may be, you know, ask advice, you know, from your pediatrician, how should I talk to my kids about these so that they understand that they are, you know, potentially dangerous and it shouldn't be a habit that they're picking up and things like that. So I encourage people to communicate with their healthcare providers and ask them for advice on how to, you know, address the issue with their children and with other smokers that they know.
That is Dr. Kristen Higgins from Emory's Winship Cancer Institute. And I have also been joined by Dr. Michael Erickson, Dean of Georgia State University's School of Public Health. He was a researcher on a recent study that found public skepticism of electronic cigarettes has tripled since 2012. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we go, let's take a moment to remember another great Georgian, Rebecca Latimer Felton. Felton was the first woman to serve in the U.S. Senate, and she took her oath of office 94 years ago this month. Felton graduated at the top of her class from Madison Female College. A year later, she married the commencement speaker from her school, a state legislator from Bartow County. He served 3 terms in the state legislature and 3 terms in the U.S. Congress, and his wife was his campaign manager and speechwriter. She wrote news articles under his name. She helped him draft bills. When he died in 1911, she remained active in politics. She fought for women's suffrage, championed the state university system, and worked very hard for other progressive reform. Racial equality was not one of her ideas on reform, though. Felton supported lynching and was instrumental in getting a professor fired from Emory when he questioned racial segregation in the South. In 1922, Senator Thomas Watson died. The governor appointed Rebecca Latimer Felton to serve until a special election could be held. So she was the first woman to serve as a senator. But here's the wrinkle on that. Congress was not in session when Watson died. It wouldn't come back into session until after the special election was over. So technically, she never actually served as a senator. She was 87 years old at the time. It was largely a symbolic honor. Rebecca Latimer Felton retains the title, though, of first female senator, sworn in almost 100 years ago this month. That's our show for today, but let's go back to earlier in this hour when we spoke to the lieutenant governor about education in the state. Give us your ideas, especially he's a big supporter of charter schools. Do you support school choice as well? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You know how to reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.